Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Miguel Delaney of The Independent, and David Priest, the coach and columnist. Okay, you lot, calm down. Denmark will be playing for a cause at Wembley on Wednesday. They have pace, intensity, and a similar spirit to the one engendered by Gareth Southgate. It's no foregone conclusion. Caution, you see, runs understandably deep. We've been let down too many times before. This, though, feels a bit different. England have an irresistible sense of momentum, more powerful because it's not being driven solely by emotion. There's strategic intent to go with a massive range of options. Now, Migs, you were in Rome. Is it time to succumb to the moment and actually make that leap of faith that they're going to win this?
I'd have them as favourites, but I must say, two games left, obviously that didn't go wrong. I think if they get to the final, especially if against Italy, it's a 50-50. But certainly, I mean, England winning a tournament is a much more likely reality, a far likelier reality, than any point basically since 1966. So, yeah, I mean, we have crossed a threshold. I mean, this team has crossed a threshold in a few ways. In terms of their outlook for the competition as a whole, they should be confident. And, of course, there's so many other dimensions to it, not least the fact that they've got two games at Wembley, and a Wembley that looks like it's going to hold up to 60,000 people with not too many away fans, unless, again, it's Italy in the final and there's a sizable element of England's Italian contingent, but it's just one other element propelling this team. But I suppose the most profound element is the structure of the team, the setup around it. And I was thinking about this after the game on Saturday. I mean, okay, Denmark is going to be a tough game, maybe the toughest England has so far, possibly even more so than Germany. But if England do it, and even if they get to the final, even if they don't win it, just the very fact they're in the final again, and that's the level they're reaching. I was even thinking about kind of the stuff we're going to write. And one of them will be basically, England have basically become, in so many ways, from the way the team is run to the infrastructure of English football now, they've become the example that they always wanted to be. Any time they were knocked out of tournaments in the past 20, 30 years, you know, looking to the German model, the French model, whatever, that's what England are now. And I suppose it's something we'll get to, you know, in a deeper sense, particularly if they do get through. But all that is behind this team. And yeah, in so many ways, they are the team to beat.
Yeah, because it is a strange one, isn't it, Dave? That, okay, we look at England almost in historical terms. You know, it's coming home. You know, that we've heard that song from 96 ad nauseam, with special reference to nauseam, for weeks now. What are the valid reference points? You see, 1966 was another world. 1996, well, the majority of this team weren't even born, although obviously Southgate played in it. Do you think maybe it's 2016 and specifically Iceland? Does it take a really seismic defeat like that to provoke real change?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you look back at sort of Germany 2002, where it sort of, even though they got to the final, kind of kick-started their revolution of how to, you know, get back on top again. But I think, you know, Miguel's right to reference what's happened at St. George's Park. It's the processes that have been put in place, especially by Dan Ashworth, those have come into fruition now. And you see like a lot of the players, and we look at that squad now and we see the characters that are in there and the relationships they have together. A lot of those players have come through a system of 5, 6, 7 years, even longer, where the culture that they're trying to create at national level with England, that's, you know, you can see it, how that's bore fruit now, because it's, you know, there's a big constant thing about Gareth Southgate, you know, about culture, about creating something more than just a football team. And on top of that, the big emphasis on behaviours, about how they should act sort of on and off the field, more so on the field. You can see that in the way that they are with each other. That's what's on top of just good football players. I think that's what we're seeing now. But also, you know, you talk about reference points. Obviously, I've got a reference point, you know, over the last 30 years. So before that, you know, I don't really know a great deal. But this team seems to be different. The way that it's set up is different. The way that the manager approaches games is different. And I know people keep saying, oh, well, he was too safe in the early stages and, you know, very defensive. These four teams now in the semi-final are four of the top five defences in the competition so far. So, you know, that flies against everything that we want. Of course, we want basketball games. We want sort of excitement and entertainment. But that doesn't win tournaments.
No, and I think that's what's striking, isn't it, Migs, that, you know, this is a tournament team that Gareth Southgate has put together. You deal with them, obviously, at a very close level. Give us an insight into what they're like, maybe away from when the cameras stop rolling. You know, this group, I look at them and I think, wow, you know, these guys are too good to be true. But there is something different going on, isn't there?
Yeah, Southgate referenced it in his press briefing yesterday, done on airport lounges from all ends. But he was talking about how, first of all, these players, they wear the right sort of confidence, which I think is true. I mean, because I suppose it's interesting this going into exactly what we're talking about, and even the debate about that song going into this last week about what arrogance in international football is and all that. But, I mean, I suppose when people kind of think of that in a sense where they're being critical, it's a sort of belligerent style of arrogance. And I don't think you could say a single one of these players are guilty of that. Even when, like, so Jack Grealish the other day said something like, so it's just the truth that he named six of the young attackers, and me and Foden and Saka and Rashford, we're all good players. And again, the way he says it, so some people might read the words written down and see and think of it as that sort of arrogance, but I don't think it is, and the way he says it certainly isn't. And that's partly to do as well, because as Southgate referenced yesterday, they all have these certain personalities that make them relatable, that means they're really palatable to the public. And even, I suppose, a little example, it was a few days before the tournament actually started, when I was up at St. George's Park, and it was the day Jack Grealish and Declan Rice were both put up for media. I obviously sent a few photos to some Irish friends and Irish journalists who obviously had a few little quips about the two boys given their history. And then, like, and then you sit down with them, though, and I remember just going to my mates in response, basically. And they're really likable lads, though. Like, particularly, there's this kind of... So with Rice, I mean, everyone knows kind of the Grealish Maverick personality, but with Rice is kind of just effusive love for football. And I think you can kind of see it in his reaction at the weekend. I think it does reflect a certain spirit of the squad. And again, Southgate spoke about that yesterday's game, where one of the things he liked the most was... I mean, he's referenced this a fair few times. And actually, it's a little bit like Mancini in this, in that he's been very conscious of the players who don't play because he wants to kind of maintain that collective spirit. But he pointed out how when Henderson scored, one of the players he had the most touching moments with was the youngest player in the squad, Jude Bellingham, who was so happy for Henderson that he'd finally got that international goal. And so that kind of link between generations. And then even you had Connor Cody, who hasn't played much in this tournament. And, like, you know, Southgate referenced how when he was looking back through, when he was doing his analysis of the game, and he just noted at the moment where Henderson's heading it, you could see Cody kind of mimicking the header as well, and kind of then the big celebration. So, yeah, there's a good spirit. As you say, I think it is something different.
Yeah, because what we've seen in the past is obviously cliques and club-driven, not disputes, but certainly suspicion. Dave, you've been in a lot of professional dressing rooms. An international dressing room, how different do you think that is in terms of, you know, you've got players in that team who are becoming mates, who basically in the next Premier League season will be going out and kicking lumps out of one another. It's a very strange dynamic, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look back at sort of the last, inverted commas, golden generation that we had. A lot of the rivalry that was stoked up, it was by the managers themselves as well. So, you know, and most notably Sir Alex Ferguson, you know. He needed that to sort of, to make them the winners that they were, kind of thing. But I think that, you look back, there's a story that's Kevin Phillips, I remember him telling me, you know, I think it's quite well known that on his first inclusion in the England squad that he was, obviously he was very nervous, and the first time they went down for a meal, he wanted to be the first one there, he didn't want to be late, so he sat there by himself. And sort of the England cap at the time, Alan Shearer comes into the dining hall and then just walks straight past him and doesn't sort of like shake his hand or welcome him. You won't find that happening now, will you? Mm. You wouldn't find happening in amongst these lads. And that's because, obviously, you don't know whether the rivalries at club level are the same, but I think a lot with football these days is that a lot of players know each other, you know, obviously before COVID, a lot of them were socialised together. It's not a case of, you know, if they were going out, they're not going out where they're from, you know. A lot of Premier League players, they go out in London, they meet each other and they become friends and across social media and things like that. So it's a different kind of relationship that footballers have these days rather than just what you see on the pitch.
Yeah, I suppose also it must be, in the wider context, Megs, be seen as pretty important that Southgate responds so readily to those, you know, the wider picture. You know, he was talking, you know, post that Ukraine win about uniting a divided country. Is that significant, do you think? Because, you know, we are conditioned almost to football being used as a bit of a symbol of the negative elements of society, you know, things like hooliganism.
Oh, yeah, completely. In fact, I was thinking this a lot before the competition began with all the debate about taking the knee. But this team, and for all the division around that, this team has the potential to be a bit like France in 1998. I mean, that 1998 team, it came at a pretty fractious point in French history, but especially as regarding immigration. And of course, you know, sport isn't so powerful that can ever completely transform anything. But it can have longer residual effects. It can change thinking. It can change perception. And that was a crucial moment in recent French history, especially as regards the perception of migrant communities. And there was that kind of brief coming together and a real kind of communal French jubilation. And I think it is possible that this team can do something. And also change the dial for a lot of people. It's because they are... I mean, it's been interesting because throughout this tournament, I think, again, the debate over the booing of taking the knee really articulated this better than anything. But it's fed in right through the tournament, right down to, say, when they play Germany and Harry Kane is appealing for people not to sing 10 German bombers. It's like we are talking about kind of classic two sides of England stuff. You know, one, that kind of reactionary right-wing England that has led to a lot of this culture war. Then on the other side, the new inclusive England, especially given the makeup of most of this team, where I think it's something like at least 14, but I think up to 16 players know they could have played for another country. And of course, but what brings these things together is ultimately, and you know, it's unfortunate that it's dependent on football results. But the flip side of that is the positive power of good football results. That's what it can do, that it can create these links or create this kind of almost a sense of communion.
Yeah. As you're saying, Migs, you know, you've got to get the results. But David, you know, what is striking about this squad is that as the tournament has gone on, it seems that Gareth Southgate's options have increased. He's played all the cards that he could really well, hasn't he?
Yeah, definitely. And it's almost all of the time, again, sort of the sway of public persuasion. And I think that's... And that's been the biggest thing for us this tournament, is that we've learned to trust him now, you know. And it's not always to say that, you know, the result always means that you've got it right or got it wrong. Certainly, if they were to get beaten this tournament in an earlier stage, it wouldn't have been because the way that he was too negative. Because, like I said, he's played all his cards right, and sometimes you do get beaten by your better side, and some people say, oh, just match up the Germans, it was a bit safe as well. That's not safe. That was, you could quite easily. I mean, they've got, a couple of world-class players that maybe is above a level that we haven't got. Obviously, Harry Kane's up there. But, like Kroos and Muller, they could have been the difference for Germany, in matching them up. They could have been the ones that were the difference. Just the way that he's given instruction to a lot of the players, and especially Luke Shaw. I wouldn't say I'm in the Jose Mourinho camp when it comes to Luke Shaw, but I certainly have a lot of questions about him. And I think the way that he's been used, and you can see he's been given clear direction in sort of his positioning and the way that he's supposed to play the game. The total contrast in the last game against Ukraine and then against Germany, where he's a lot more conservative. And then you put him in that position against Ukraine, you get the best out of him. That's one of the biggest things for Gareth Southgate this tournament, is that he's got it right in individual instruction and also the way he's set up.
Yeah, because in many ways, Migs, it's been a bit of a tournament of redemption. Dave mentioned Luke Shaw then, who probably is right to revel in Jose Mourinho's discomfort at his progress. You've had Maguire, those sort of yeoman qualities that we expect of English centre-halves, that's come through. Harry Kane being given time to be himself. There is that sense, isn't there, that it's not just about young players breaking through. It's about more experienced players responding to the moment.
Oh, yeah, totally. I think probably for all the focus on youth in the squad, as you say, I think Saturday, more than any other game, was a victory for the old guard. And if the game against Germany was, a big psychological barrier knocked down for the team as a whole, this felt actually another one in a very different way, in terms of just it made so many criticisms and questions go away. So if you look right through that old garden, and again, Southgate referenced it after the game, you've got Pickford, who hasn't had the best last 2 years, to be fair. There's even been kind of questions at Everton about, I was looking at one forum yesterday on one of the Everton sites about, where there were basically a debate about whether they should sell him. He's kept his fifth clean sheet, made a big save early in the game when it was just 1-0. Could have been a key moment for as easy as the game become. Maguire started the season with that case in Greece, ends it with injury causing to miss the Europa League final. Calls for Southgate not to pick him. He's part of that defence as well and scores his first goal. Jordan Henderson gets his first international goal after similar questions as regards injury as Maguire. Sterling, of course, who literally on the eve of the tournament spoke about his unhappiness and not playing football. Not playing as much football as he'd want for Man City, has been one of the players of the tournament, maybe the player of the tournament. And Kane, of course, is just what last week where there were questions over whether he should be dropped after maybe an indifferent end to the season. And now we're talking about, not quite a potential Paolo Rossi, given Kane has been banging him in for the last 2 years, but where he suddenly, but maybe a Paolo Rossi in the sense that he grows into a tournament and can yet be top scorer. And then so suddenly we've got this kind of belief running right through the squad in every facet. And I suppose, Preece, you mentioned the kind of the clicks and all that earlier. But, there was a genuine potential for problems in that this summer, Manchester City are trying to offload Raheem Sterling to bring in Jack Grealish and Harry Kane. It could have caused difficulties that suddenly Sterling's expected to supply or link up with two players who are kind of potentially causing him issues in his club career. But there's been none of that. In fact, quite the opposite, particularly given what we saw on Saturday for that first goal.
Yeah, it was interesting, when you mention Jordan Pickford, David, first England goalkeeper to record 5 clean sheets in a major tournament, beat Gordon Banks, who went 442 minutes without conceding in 1966. He has answered his critics, but there was a moment, a little vignette towards the end of that game against Ukraine, where you could hear Steve Holland yelling, defend properly, when he had one of those little mad moments, the brain fade where he came out and sliced the ball. Do we just have to accept that that's in his makeup?
It's a good question, but simply because for England, we don't see what we've seen for Everton for the last 2 years, which is the inconsistency. You know, he did finish the season. You know, he had hit, missed a few games with a rib injury and then came back in and finished the season really well. And for England, the shirt does have somewhat of a calming effect on me, even though, you know, I've heard a lot of people talking about, you know, how he shouts at the defence. And sometimes that's all right if the relationship between the two is good. You know, if they accept that's the way he is and he thinks he's got to be like that to keep himself in the game, because what's happening with England in opposed to Everton, he's not involved a lot with England games. He's having to show maturity, whereas before that he might have went to, you know, come and take crosses that he doesn't even get involved in, trying to manufacture situations so he can show how good he is. But it's not the case for England. And I think that, yeah, a couple of things in the later stages of the game that was, one, through ball, it was a difficult ball that to volley away. You know, I think he's chose the hardest way to deal with that rather than just maybe his chest up, head out away. And the other one was the missed kick on his weaker right foot that went straight to a Ukraine player. And at 4-0, as a coach, you don't want to get sloppy. That's what Steve Holland, he doesn't want sloppiness to creep in. And even at 4-0, you know, if you finish 4-2, by giving a couple of stupid goals away, it takes a massive shine out of the performance and how dominating it was. But it's something they've got to be mindful of. But I really don't think that they're going to be in a situation again in this tournament, they definitely won't be, where they're going to be that comfortable and allow themselves to get sort of sloppy in the last sort of 20, 30 minutes of the game. Because, I mean, let's face it, once that fourth goal went in, it was a procession really, you know?
Yeah, no procession on Wednesday. There are some interesting selection decisions to be made, as ever, Migs. You know, you've had two players who, you know, have had remarkable seasons in many ways. Mason Mount, Champions League winner, probably essential England player now, so early in his career. Jadon Sancho came in. It seemed that he is almost ready to reach another level after, you know, his transfer business with Manchester United has been sorted out. You've got Bakary Saka being available again. Which way will Southgate jump, do you think?
Well, I mean, this is one of the fascinating things of this tournament. I think Preecy alluded to it there as well, that when we went into this tournament, for months, I suppose, but particularly in the weeks before, right up to the Croatia game, the huge debate, in fact, it was something that a lot of people around players said, where there was almost this kind of wait for people to kind of be able to criticise Southgate, who's, oh, he doesn't know his best 11. That's the problem. He's got to know his best 11. Whereas that has just been completely demolished as an argument, because he's just gone for horses for courses approach and picked teams to fit. And it's worked perfectly so far. Well, certainly perfectly in defence, which has seen a lot of chopping and changing too. And they've been potent enough up front with the release we saw on Saturday. And I suppose there's a few other kind of interesting angles to that as well, in terms of, I don't think any England player, say, has had a bad, quote-unquote, bad turn brand like that. But I suppose just as an indication of how things shift, I suppose, and how much variety there is in this squad. We went into the Euros kind of talking about Phil Foden as a potential Gascoigne, but I suppose the opposite has happened in that, because of the strength and depth elsewhere and because of the performance of other, he hasn't really had too many minutes. In fact, like him hitting the post against Croatia now seems months ago. I mean, I suppose that's the nature of tournaments in general. But and that's no reflection on Foden. Although there's maybe a slight, not an issue, but maybe just a different context for him, in the Manchester City system, it's so structured and coordinated in a way that is impossible in international football. Maybe there's an adjustment to that, and maybe in that context, some of the other players are better able to fit into Southgate's system, or at least in this tournament. And there's no question Foden's going to be a superb player for England in the future and a dominant player. But just it just shows the depth Southgate has. And even for Sancho to suddenly come in, because it was, again, a similar debate over him and similar questions over why Southgate wasn't playing Sancho, then he's able to just slot him in to absolutely no negative effect, but only positive effect for a major tournament quarterfinal.
Blame Denmark. You know, as I said in the intro, David, they've got the power of a cause, Christian Eriksen, obviously. Do we in the media think read too much in that? But although when you're in the inside in the dressing room and you see a teammate in that situation and you've got a country feeling probably the same way, Does that actually have any competitive bearing at all?
I mean, it's something that will probably be in the will always be in the forefront of their minds. It could be something that's mentioned in the dressing room beforehand, you know, do it for Christian and everything like that. But also now, I think they've probably got past that now. I think in the, you know, the Belgium game and perhaps the Wales game, there's, you know, there's a lot of emotion, you know, flying around. But off the back of four goals against Russia, four goals against Wales, the win the other night, you know, it's a different kind of sort of, it's the confidence that's flown through them now. And so rather than that just being the real motivation, now it's sort of like, not, I don't want to say it's secondary, but it's just an added thing for them to go on and perform well. Rather than it being sort of too overbearing, too emotional, now it's like the cherry on top of the cake. Now we can, you know, go and perform, and then at the end of the game we can say it's for Christian, and that's how we want to do it. And I mean, to be honest with you, I spoke to a few people back in Denmark, and I've got a friend who's working over there now. And even in the group stages, we set ourselves, we don't really want to meet Denmark. We're really fearful of them. And I think that, you know, they've shown since the group stages, quite rightly, they need to be feared. Because, again, they're not just got good players, they're a very good side. And Kasper Juhlmann's got them playing really, really well. And you've got to think as well, I think they've only lost two games out of the last 30, maybe three games out of the last 31. So coming into this tournament as well, it's not like they're just surprising everyone now. And of course, the last two games against England, they've beaten us and drawn with us. So it's going to be a tight one, I think.
Yeah, and you know, you can see parallels with the England squad. You know, similarly empathetic coach. You've got their own redemption stories. You know, Kasper Dolberg, you know, three goals in this tournament. He's had his problems at Nice, you know, including COVID after leaving Ajax. What do you make of them, Migs?
Very impressed, yeah. I think Dave is right. I think they were on an emotional wave, but that has almost given rise to something else, which is just a growing belief in their play as a team. And I think also you can almost see it in their football as well. Whereas, I mean, I was at both of those games in the Nations League when they drew at England and beat them. And I suppose as much due to England as Denmark, they were very kind of restrained games and kind of tactical games, where I suppose a little bit like England in terms of the football, well, at least England against Ukraine and maybe Germany, there's been that release to the Danish side as well. They're not just kind of, it's not just strategic, but there's, you know, the emotional sweep around the team has given way to this sweep of attacking in their football. I think we particularly saw that in the Welsh game. There's no fear about this team, and I suppose that's an advantage going into a semi-final as well, where it's a potential psychological advantage going into a final where not quite that everything now is a bonus. I mean, we are talking about previous European champions. That's something that England haven't done. They haven't lifted the Euros. Denmark have. They have that as part of their legacy. But because they're, I don't think it's unfair to say maybe they're the fourth favourites of the four teams left. And so there's no pressure in that regard. They're already absolute heroes. So they can play with a certain freedom that'll maybe mitigate some of the advantages England have, like that home crowd. I think it's, I genuinely think it's a much more awkward and difficult game than Germany. Okay, it doesn't have the psychological weight of the Germany game for the players or the country or the crowd, but it has other elements that are just, particularly just in general play. And because I think they're a much better set up team than Germany, even though they don't have the same quality, that's going to make it tough for England. Maybe their biggest challenge so far. I suppose this is the other interesting thing about the game as well. I mean, say, like, I know we'll come on to the other semi-final in a little bit, but say if you look at Spain, where their whole tournament has basically been setback after setback after setback, going right back to the start of it in terms of kind of Busquets getting COVID, and they've recovered. Whereas England's actually been the opposite. There hasn't been a single setback yet. It's been so smooth. And I suppose that's, I mean, obviously the main psychological barrier we're talking about is finally getting beyond a semi-final for the first time since 66. But part of that may be if England concede a goal or if a game goes difficult. That's the one thing we haven't yet seen from this team. And it's not to say they're not capable of it or that it's an issue, but it would just be interesting or instructive to see how they'd react to that. But, you know, maybe we'll see what we've seen so far, and they'll just, there'll be no setback against Denmark either.
Yeah, what was it Mike Tyson said? Everyone's a hard man until they get punched in the mouth. I suppose we might see what's going on there. The other thing, I suppose, David, is just, you know, we talked about England's range of options. Denmark have had seven separate goal scorers in this tournament, which has got to be a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, they're not too thin on the ground when it comes to squad as well. And, you know, they've got good defensive cover. Joachim Andersen, Zanke Jorgensen, who was at Huddersfield a couple of seasons ago. Robert Skou, who's at Hoffenheim, he hasn't really played that much. And obviously Yusuf Poulsen's been out injured, so he'll be fully, should be fully fit when he's for our game. So it's, yeah, they've got a lot of options. And just looking at, like you mentioned, Kasper Dolberg there and the likes of Martin Braithwaite, it just kind of reminds me, when I was in Denmark, you know, there was a film that came out called Odeva Denmark, which is like, and it was Denmark, about the whole sort of 1992. But it went right back to...
I literally watched that last night.
Yeah.
Would you believe?
Oh, mate, it's brilliant, mate, isn't it? And I think that...
I really enjoyed it.
And it goes back to sort of when... sort of the early 80s, when the Danish FA wanted to, you know, they thought they needed something, you know, to do something different. They were sick of... The players would turn up and see it as a bit of a holiday. But it, in fact, when, you know, you look at it, you transfer that to now, the likes of Dolberg, who you mentioned the troubles he's had. I think one of his teammates has just been sacked because he stole a watch from him in the dressing room. Martin Braithwaite, you know, obviously it's a huge move to Barcelona that's, you know, a lot of people would say that he's not quite up to that standard. Coming into this tournament and coming to this group of players and actually being in Denmark while they're doing this for most of the time, it is a kind of relief for them. It is a kind of sort of forget about all your troubles and, you know, focus on something positive. And it is something that, like I said, it harks back to the previous eras where they've had unbelievable teams. And I think that's what we've got to acknowledge as well. I mean, Denmark over the last 30 years have had some tremendous players for such a small country. And we talk about, you know, you mentioned arrogance for the England players before. People probably don't realise that the Danes do have a real sort of streak of arrogance in them. They are a kind of a mixture of Scandinavian, a little bit British, and a little bit of German as well. And all their players, you look at someone like Christian Eriksen. Christian Eriksen's quiet, humble, unassuming, but he's got a real steel about how he wants to play and the confidence in himself. And I think a lot of the players, you know, regardless of their talent, you know, a lot of the Danish players do have that as well.
Yeah. Just one final point, Migs, on this semi. Very few Danish fans at Wembley on Wednesday. England have had none of the exhaustive travel endured by other teams. You know, it's ludicrous, probably, that Denmark had to play in Baku, isn't it, on Friday night, which can only be down to UEFA's, you know, political expedience, probably. Is this tournament being played on a level playing field?
Not quite, certainly not in terms of home advantage. But again, I think maybe that's sometimes the kind of, I suppose, fortuitiveness that comes with winning tournaments. And in a similar way, well, not in a similar way, but in the way that in 1992, just almost because they came into the tournament late, things ended up kind of falling in a strange way for Denmark. There has been a kind of a slight haphazardness, a haphazardness elsewhere that's fallen in place for England. Because let's not forget, their group games were supposed to be in Brussels, except for the fact that the Belgians had to pull out of that project in 2017 because it wasn't going to be done in time. I can't remember the exact specifics. But yeah, those games were supposed to be in Brussels and they were moved in 2017. And of course, up until about a month or two ago, the last 16 game against Germany was supposed to be in Dublin, except for the Irish government was unwilling or wasn't confident enough to make guarantees in terms of the numbers that would be possible at games. And it's still quite restrictive in Ireland at the moment. So by contrast, this actually, a semi-final would have been England's grand homecoming this summer had this competition gone in the way it was supposed to. But instead, it's been very different. It's been virtually a home tournament for the team. And even that might have fallen well for England, because Southgate made a point of this before the Ukraine game, where he said he was actually happy that their next game was away from Wembley, because he didn't think the Wembley crowd would be able to match, this is, I suppose, an inevitable human thing, but he think that they wouldn't have been able to match just the emotion that went into the Germany game. And it could have just maybe created that bit more of a kind of not pressurized atmosphere, but just a slightly different context that made it that bit more difficult. Maybe it was that bit flatter, especially after kind of the Lord Mayor show of the Germany game. So in that way, maybe this one away game, the game in Rome, fell for England as well. And now they come back to what is going to be another massive event. There is an interesting thing, actually, where I think there's a historical stat where the stage that hosts most get to and go out at is actually the semi-final. And there's so many recent examples.
Right. That's something to ponder, isn't it?
Sorry.
The other semi-final, Dave, Italy, 32 games unbeaten, pretty cohesive. You would think that they're probably worthy favourites. I just want to look at Roberto Mancini, if I could, please. He seems to have had, he sort of instigated a bit of a quiet revolution there, hasn't he? There's a lot of familiar virtues in that team. But it also, a bit like England, feels a bit different.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in many ways, they're a very un-Italian team. But I think we've seen in the last 15 minutes of the Belgium game, you know, that the strengths still lie there, you know. Chiellini and Bonucci, just remarkable defenders, just two defenders who you would want to be in front of you if you were a goalkeeper. It just shows that a lot of it, I mean, of course, they're very good defenders, that, you know, they're very clever defenders, how they position themselves, and particularly in blocking shots, who showed up for years, Juventus, that their positioning is just incredibly accurate. But I think that it's the mentality that they have. But on top of that, Mancini's built on top of that. You know, he's got players like Jorginho, who a lot of people would just say he's a bit of a crab. You know, he plays the simple passes. Doesn't affect games. Maybe is it how fans want him to see. But you see him now, as soon as he gets the ball, he's playing balls forward, spits through the lines. When they need to, they can have patient build-up. But a lot of time, they're very direct with the passing. And they've got so many options that, I mean, Spinazzola is going to be a big loss for them on that left-hand side. And I think it was really good. You know, we talk about the culture that Gareth Southgate's formed with England. But you look at, there was a video that went out, I think, on breakfast the next morning, and Spinazzola's there on his crutches. Obviously, he's tore his Achilles, you know, and every player in the squad, every member of staff came up and hugged him and kissed him, and it seemed really genuine, and it was quite moving, actually, you know, and it just shows the strength of that squad as well. And Mancini's got to take a lot of credit for that. And behind the scenes, you know, you look at Lombardi and Gianluca Vialli and his backroom staff as well. They've all played important parts in forming that team. And Mancini's got to take a lot of credit for it, you know. You know, he's not the coach that he was at Man City, you know. He's still got great players at his disposal here. But he's formed that team to play the way they are now, and it's, credit to him.
Yeah, it was a brilliant photograph I saw after that, the win at the weekend or Friday night, where Mancini is in the middle of the huddle and he's got his index finger pointing at them. And I was struck by the faces of the players. They were wired into him, you know. They weren't looking anywhere else, and you could see the joy on their faces, and the intensity was fantastic. And, you know, I spoke a little bit about familiar virtues, Migs, but let's look at some familiar faults, shall we? Immobile rolling around like that, you know, what are we going to do? I just found that embarrassing. And secondly, you know, that last 20 minutes, that was a masterclass, wasn't it, of how to kill a game off?
Oh, yeah, that's it. I mean, one man's fault is another man's expert game management. just the brazen, blatant nature of it was remarkable. But yeah, I mean, I've been talking to people since the Friday night game. We were in Rome for it as well, watching it from our hotel due to the UEFA bubble, so we didn't get too much of the atmosphere. But I mean, there's that. As much as the football this team plays is a symbol of a new Italian style as they kind of embrace football modernity, there is still that element as if, kind of, as we saw in the last 15 minutes, a leopard doesn't change its spots. That's what they really love to do, to really dig in, really defend. And of course, so much has been made of the way, more than any other team in this tournament, or more than any other, you know, national team almost in general, they really celebrate hard defending. kind of proper defending and the sort of those sort of really kind of defiant challenges that make a difference. And it's also it becomes defending that's hard not to kind of to really enjoy in a way you would enjoy attacking football. I mean, like I suppose like most people, ultimately it's what it's attacking football and open games that get me going, and it's why you watch. And yet when I think of defensive performances that I've genuinely enjoyed, and like you, where you really get into them from a defensive perspective, I think nearly all of them are from either Italian club teams or the Italian national team. And one of the ones that comes to mind the most beyond last night was the Euro 2000 semi-final against the Netherlands.
Yeah, well, you know, I think Chiellini in particular is just a rock star at the back, isn't he? He's fantastic. Need a good goalkeeper, David. Gianluigi Donnarumma, a worthy heir to Buffon?
He's certainly proven it. I think since he came into the side at 16, AC Milan side at 16, I'd kind of just sort of slept on him a little bit, just waiting for him just to not to grow his potential. But I mean, at 22 years old, over 200 games in Serie A, 30 games for Italy, you know, it's a remarkable feat. And the way that he carries himself, it belies his age, really. And I think that, you know, he's not had an untroubled career so far. You know, he had all the controversy over turning down the contract offer at AC Milan and being forced to re-sign again when the ultras had a little word with him. but of course, now that his contract is expired, looks like he's got a PSG. And I think it's probably one of the biggest things that over the past few seasons at AC Milan that he's not been there at the top end of, you know, winning titles, you know, last stages of European competitions, you know, and that's probably kept him in the dark a little bit. But there's no doubt that this is a world-class goalkeeper. He's the one, wonder kid of goalkeeping at the moment. And he looks anything like a kid, to be honest with you. And similarly to Jordan Pickford, you know, he's been well protected, there's no doubt. I mean, you look at all the great goalkeepers in the past, you know, you mentioned Buffon there, even in English terms, David Seaman at Arsenal. You know, you still have to be very well protected, but the key is to be there when you need it. And he's certainly that. And I mean, you look at it, I know it's a little bit simplistic, but you look at the frame of the guy and the saves that he's making. He looks unbeatable himself, you know. So it's and also for somebody, you know, I hate to say this, for a big man, he's very comfortable on the ball. He moves really well, you know, and it, like I said, allied with his physical attributes. You know, if he does go to PSG, which looks likely, they've got themselves a world-class goalkeeper for the next 10, 12 years at least.
Yeah, good feat for a big man, eh? Spain, Mix, have they been progressing without really impressing, do you think?
I think there's a bit of that. I think because in terms of the evolution of the team, I don't think that's really happened in a way we've seen with, say, England. But I think what has evolved really impressively with Spain is psychologically. I mean, just I was thinking about this after they went through against Switzerland. It's like they faced a setback at almost every turn of this competition. And so many previous Spanish generations, and actually particularly the teams of the last three tournaments, which is almost like this massive hangover after kind of the greatest era of success that international football has ever known, it would have knocked them out. But it hasn't. In fact, it almost feels as if just as the problems get all the more profound, they actually react in an even bigger way. So, of course, we started off with Busquets' COVID case, which disrupted really, and I think it's probably been overlooked just how much that disrupted their plans. Like Luis Enrique, he's obviously been very conscious of changing Spain's whole style, making them more direct so they don't fall into these traps of endless possession. And then he was denied a week of preparation with the team. And I think that's maybe why we saw those first two games where it was very kind of the worst of Spain and just perennially passing it sideways without kind of any sort of breakthrough. And kind of these games, it almost became philosophical existential crises against Sweden and Poland. Then, of course, they play Slovakia. Morata, who's been kind of almost, you know, one of the main figures in terms of a psychodrama in the tournament, misses the penalty. They finally they break through, but then they end up finishing second in the group. Against Croatia, of course, it's almost as if that this whole joke about passing reaches an absolute parody in that they literally pass the ball into their own net. Yeah, they recover from that to go and win that game twice. And even Morata, of course, who even not just in the tournament, but even in that game, missed two massive chances, ends up scoring the key goal. And he's not the only hero in it. There's also Unai Simon. In fact, I'll be interested to hear what Parisi thinks about Simon for those penalties. But even before the shootout against Switzerland, he made two huge saves. One at 2-1 in the Croatia game. Then another at 3-all just to start the extra time. And then, of course, the Switzerland game, after a tournament where, or sorry, a year where Spain, I think it was missed six consecutive penalties, a game that seemed such classic Spain in that they battered Switzerland this time. Again, it was almost like the strikers were a parody and missed chances they should never have missed. And then it goes to penalties and you think this is it, it should be doom. And they get through. And with the keeper, I mean, I was really impressed with Simon. And it was almost like, almost felt the opposite to Joe Hart in 2012, where his antic, whereas it was almost if in 2012, Joe Hart surrendered that game to Pirlo and surrendered to psychology. In this case, it was the goalkeeper recapturing the psychology of the penalty shootout through the way he was moving on his line and how intimidating he made himself.
Yeah, well, there's been a familiar theme through all this is redemption. With Simon, David, I think it wasn't that long ago, he was fourth choice at his club. An amazing turnaround.
Yeah, it's just the life of the goalkeeper, really, when you're in the background and you're hoping for a loss of form or an injury to get you into the top spot so you can try and prove yourself. And I think it's kind of happened with him, you know, the loss of form of De Gea and Kepa. It's put him in the position where, well, I think he's proved his manager right, you know. And I quite liked it around the, you know, the when he conceded that horrendous goal, and of course it was. But I think that even going back to the behaviours that England have sort of tried to implement and make sure that they do the right actions on the pitch, right behaviours, it has to come from the manager as well. And the manager was very good, you know, just saying that, you know, if these things happen and, you know, it's about how you move on, it's the next action that matters rather than the mistake. And he backed him all the way. And I think he's saying that the two huge saves that he made and the penalty shootout, especially the penalty shootout, the difference between him and sort of like what Joe Hart was trying to do and seeing other keeps trying to do, try and shout and put him off. You have to do something with your body to upset it's called like the double OP loop of how somebody comes to make a decision and an action, certainly in a penalty shootout. And for instance, if you've seen this season in France, I think it was a PSG game with the opposition keeper, he just stood to the side of his goal, just stood to one side. And all that does, it just upsets the processes that the penalty takers finds natural and just puts a glitch in it. And like you're saying, that Neymar just didn't even hit the target. And it was the same the other night, I think. The fact that he was moving along his line, it just puts a glitch in the mind of the taker. And it so often happens, you know, it so often happens that the taker either changes their mind or puts a little thought in their mind that upsets it and makes it so difficult. And it's clever from him. And we've seen a lot more this past tournament as well.
Yeah, well, there's a thought. It certainly prompted the thought of yet another penalty shootout on Wednesday night. Don't think anyone will look forward to that. Just finally, gents, you know, briefly, please, name your finalists. Migs, can you go first, please?
I want to say Spain as a half Spaniard, but I think Italy just are too good at controlling games, whereas Spain have favoured games of control. So I think it's going to be Italy, England.
Dave?
Yeah, I can't argue with that. Well, we've all got fingers crossed that's going to be the final anyway.
Yeah, me too. This is a team that reaches the parts that other England teams haven't reached. The leadership's outstanding, the principles are sound, the personalities are appealing. There's only one thing to do now, sit back and keep enjoying the ride. While we do so, I better thank David and Miguel for their insight and to you for listening to the Football Writers Podcast. Enjoy the game.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.